Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hello, I'm Roland Martin. Today on News One Now, Common and John Legend win the Oscar for Best Original Song. And the performance of Glory brought the audience there to tears. What's up with all the black folks who are presenting? Was Oscar trying to tell us we love black people? We'll break it down with our panel. Also, the hit Fox series Empire has brought end-of-life issues to the forefront. We'll break down the steps that will help you and your family prepare for end-of-life decisions. Plus, we'll talk with an Emmy Award-winning journalist who talks about losing a ton of weight and coming to the point of self-acceptance in the new book, Finspired. Plus, neo-soul singing sensation Raheem Devon drops a new album, Love, Sex, Passion. We'll break down what it means by love, sex, and passion. Time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. Well, you heard them say John Stevens and Lonnie Lynn. We know them as Common and John Legend. They won the Oscar for Best Song last night. Of course, they previously won for NAACP Image Award, also the Golden Globe. But a lot of folks were not just talking about the performance that took place, but also the acceptance speech. Let's play the performance first, and then we'll also hear Common and John Legend and the critical points they brought up to the world who was watching last night.
Glory,
when it's lost and died,
glory,
we'll cry glory,
glory,
oh glory, oh
glory.
Now, of course, that's the audience responding. Lots of folks were shedding tears, not just there in the audience, but also at home. I want to come to our panel because one of the things that that was brought up last night, Common and John Legend both brought up some critical points in their acceptance speech. So do we have the acceptance speech ready? If so, let's actually play that. So here's Common and John Legend last night.
First, I would like to thank God that lives in us all. Recently, John and I got to go to Selma and perform Glory on the same bridge that Dr. King and the people of the Civil Rights Movement marched on 50 years ago. This bridge was once a landmark of a divided nation, but now is a symbol for change. The spirit of this bridge transcends race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, and social status. The spirit of this bridge connects the kid from the south side of Chicago, dreaming of a better life, to those in France standing up for their freedom of expression, to the people in Hong Kong protesting for democracy. This bridge was built on hope, welded with compassion, and elevated by love for all human beings.
Thank you. Nina Simone said, "It's an artist's duty to reflect the times in which we live." We wrote this song for a film that was based on events that were 50 years ago, but we say that Selma is now because the struggle for justice is right now. Yeah. We know that the voting rights, that act that they fought for 50 years ago is being compromised right now in this country today. We know that right now, the struggle for freedom and justice is real. We live in the most incarcerated country in the world. There are more black men under correctional control today than were under slavery in 1850. When people are marching with our song, we want to tell you we are with you, We see you, we love you, and march on. God bless you.
Thank you, Ava. Thank you, Ava. Thank you. Thank you, Ava.
Let's talk about this with our panel. We have attorney Monique Presley, principal of the Presley Firm, also attorney and blogger April Rain. Of course, many folks know her from also creating the hashtag OscarSoWhite. We have Stephanie Brown James, CEO and founding partner of Vested Strategies, and Huey Newsom, contributor at Project 21. Monique, I want to start with you and go to everyone on our panel. Just how important was it to not only have them not just win the song, but raise those important issues, because that's really what an extension of really what Selma was about.
Right. So they took the moment and they made the moment. They seized an opportunity and did what we hope people would. So we might not have been winning in every category. We should have been nominated and winning in many more categories. But for two African-American males to not just win in that category, but raise voting rights, which is huge, raise sentencing guidelines, incarceration numbers. Those are things that people were listening to many for the first time. So I think that they made the most of that moment and they said things that needed to be said. I appreciated it.
Yeah, and I love the fact that, you know, these are two artists who, you know, John Legend made reference to Nina Simone. We just celebrated her birthday a few days ago. And really, these are not just artists, they are activists who are using the platform that they have to give a message that, quite frankly, we haven't heard enough in the public narrative. I mean, to talk about voting rights being under attack. This is the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. You don't hear a lot about it in the news, so to use that platform at the Oscars in the international way, I mean, that was brilliant.
I think it's a great example of changing a negative into a positive, because you think about all the things that took place about a month ago when all the snubs came out and all the negative press came out. Obviously, you know, Hollywood was trying to balance itself and make sure that enough of people of color had a chance to get a platform. And they used that platform for a very positive reason, for a very positive cause.
April?
I really appreciate the fact that John Legend and Common took the opportunity to speak out about the problems that we see in America and in society as a whole. They really seized upon the platform, and it was necessary that they do so, because we don't have a lot of activists out there who are able to use the moment the way that they did for the benefit of all.
And also, I mean, well, a lot of people, look, when you think about the movies out there, you could talk about Birdman, you could talk about some of the other films, but this was the only film there that was dealing with social justice, dealing with issues that was 50 years ago, but is still alive today.
Well, I mean, you also had The Imitation Game, which talked about the homophobia back during the Nazi rule in London and in Europe. But Selma was the poignant film that really, to me, brought home the bridge of 50 years ago to now. You know, they were able to, in that short amount of time that John Legend and Common were on stage, they were able to sum up the emotions that so many people who were watching, who maybe were boycotting the Oscars this year, that they felt, and they did it in such an austere and powerful way. It was really proud to see.
No, and again, first of all, if you look at the history of the Oscars has no problem when it comes to actually awarding black folks when it comes to best song, because we've always been able to sing. But when it comes to directing and acting, it's a whole different deal. When we come back, we're going to deal with this particular issue, because it seemed with all of these black presenters, I swear, if you were black and in that audience and you were not on stage, you might want to see if you still have your black card. Because they seem to use anybody who was black to present last night. We'll talk about that when we come back right here on News One Now on TV One. We'll also deal with the issue of losing weight and self-acceptance with the author of the book, Thin Spirit. Plus, later in the show, Raheem Devon talks about his new album, Love, Sex, Passion, and he breaks down what it means by love, sex, passion. 8 after the hour, News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
All right, folks, welcome back to News One Now. It was very interesting yesterday. Y'all can go ahead and roll. Did y'all see all the presenters of the Oscars? First of all, I didn't watch the show, but I swear, go ahead and roll the video. These are all the folks who were presenting last night. As Chiwetel, you had David Oyelowo, that somebody could pronounce his doggone name, Terrence Howard. Lucius Idris Elba, he was presenting, Lupita Nyong'o, Kerry Washington, Oprah Winfrey, Eddie Murphy, and Kevin Hart, Octavia Spencer, Viola Davis. Okay, Oscars, we got it. Y'all were trying to let everybody know that in a year where we got ripped for not nominating Ava for Best Director, not nominating David Oyelowo for Best Actor, we really love black people. But here's also an interesting point. There was supposed to be a protest before the Oscars protesting this, and Ava DuVernay actually asked for them not to do the protest. April, you created the hashtag OscarsSoWhite, got lots of attention when the nominations came down. What did you make of the Academy saying, we love black people?
I think that it proves that we were getting our point across, that at the very last minute, the Academy was attempting to make the presenters and make the presentation as a whole, the broadcast, more diverse by bringing in presenters who didn't have necessarily new movies coming out, who were not
even previous nominees or winners.
Absolutely.
The Rock presented, Zoe Saldana. Didn't Michael Strahan also present or do something?
I think he did something. I don't think he presented, but I think there's something deeper here. I think that clearly the Academy is trying to compensate for the misgivings with Best Director, with the Best Director snub and the Best Actor snub. But this isn't the first time that's happened. If you think about it, you look at Will Smith and Muhammad Ali. You think about Denzel Washington need to portray a renegade cop in Training Day to get his Oscar. You think about the negative portrayals that are getting the attention of the Academy for black actors and even black actresses for them to win Best Actor, Best Actress.
Well, but as a fact, first of all, the difference between Muhammad Ali and Will Smith playing him, he was nominated.
Yes, he was nominated.
Denzel was nominated for Malcolm X.
But if you look at the actual winners,
right?
Oh, absolutely.
Especially when we're talking about Best Actress, they were either in subservient roles as as maids, when we talk about Hattie McDaniel, when we talk about The Help, or they were deeply flawed and troubled characters. If we talk about Whoopi's character, the fake psychic in Ghost, and we talk about Halle Berry's character in Monsters Ball. So we still are not seeing the richness and complexity of our stories.
But here's the deal. I mean, Hollywood also, frankly, when Angelina Jolie won, she won for A Crazy Drunk Woman in an insane asylum. I mean, bottom line is, for some reason in Hollywood, if you play these crazy, deranged characters, somehow that's considered acting.
Right, and I hate it when we do that. I understand the point that the people who won those Oscars were playing in subservient roles, but they were doing a spectacular job. I mean, there was excellent acting job done by each of those women, and they played roles that were real, that come from our history, a history that I don't think we should try to disconnect to, as if because someone does a great job of showcasing it, it somehow shames us or embarrasses us. Those are our grandmothers. Those are our great-grandmothers. Those are real things that happen.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah. At all. I appreciate all of the performances, but we also had Belle, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, which was a very strong character, and she was not in a subservient role. We also had David Oyelowo playing Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and that was a very strong and important role. We had Denzel Washington playing Malcolm X. So what I'm saying is that there is more out there than just subservient roles.
I think one of the things that obviously the attention being brought to bear here is critically important is that our voices do matter. There's no doubt in my mind you would not have seen that many black presenters had there not been any criticism. But at the end of the day, what people also must understand is this goes beyond, for me, it goes beyond the Oscars. It goes to the Sony hacked emails. It goes to who is sitting in these rooms. There has never been an African-American who's ever run a Hollywood studio, ever. Mm-hmm. You never had an African-American who's been in the number two position of a Hollywood studio. But you got black folks who can run American Express, who can run Xerox, who can run McDonald's, somehow can't run a Hollywood studio. And that's really where the power in Hollywood is not who's in front of the camera. The power is who's behind the cameras, and the reality is we are not in those power positions.
And that was exactly the point of the OscarsSoWhite hashtag, that it wasn't just the actors and the actresses, but it was all about from the top down, from the studio executives, and who had the power to greenlight these films, and what are the questions that they're asking in the boardroom when they're making the decision. So if we look at the movie that just won Best Picture, Birdman, fantastic film, great performance by Michael Eaton, but when the decision was being made about who to cast in that film, did Andy Garcia get a call? Did Ken Watanabe's agent get a call? Could anybody else of color played that role? And in fact, could a woman have played that role? Could that have been a movie about a woman?
Before people of color of Mexican descent were the ones who wrote the movie, who produced the movie, who directed the movie, who won for Best Director last night. You know, I think that we are seeing some progress being made. The head of the Motion Picture Academy is Cheryl Boone Isaac. She's an African-American woman. She has publicly spoken out about the need for diversity in motion pictures.
But the reason I have to push this harder on this, because again, here's the whole point. When I go to junkets, when I get the staff, does not look like this panel. Look at the people who are the publicists.
Right.
And then if you go and you look at the people who are in development, you look at the people then who are executives, I'm sorry, they don't look like us. This also, for me, goes to the point of income inequality. Because when we can only do certain jobs, but we never get to be able to do the high six-figure jobs and the seven-figure jobs, and then the decision-making jobs, that directly deals with who is controlling the narrative and what is the image that's being projected across the country. And then when we also don't control the studio, then that's what happens when they say, well, we can't even show black films overseas, even though you actually can, but you choose not to.
But
nobody is going to give that to us. We have to take it. They may hand us some presenter slots, and they may say, okay, feel better about it because there are 10 of you up there on stage, 10 spectacular, talented people who deserve to be there. But still, that's a gesture. When it comes down to mobilizing the resources, the finances to take the power seat and do something with it, it's on us as African Americans.
That's what Tyler Perry has done. Tyler Perry had to go outside of Hollywood and literally create his own studio so that he could tell his stories.
I agree with you, but he still had to do a distribution deal with Lionsgate. He no longer has that deal because they've actually parted ways. He's not focusing on television. But again, even when you are able to make your own film, it's still a question of dealing with a system that still excludes us. And if you look at his films, they will not show his films overseas, even though when Martin Lawrence was in Big Mama's house, a guy put on the dress, they showed that movie overseas, and nearly 70% of the money it made came from the foreign market. And so even when a Tyler does his thing, they still will prevent us from being able to go beyond that for whatever reason.
Right. I mean, the fact that Spike Lee still has to crowdsource his film.
Oh, no doubt.
And raise money speaks to the overwhelming problem that we still have.
Yep.
You know, someone with Spike's pedigree should be able to get anything that he wants greenlit.
And there's a very important message here.
40 seconds.
Because if entertainment is a very important channel to portray positive or negative messages.
No doubt.
Resonate with people in the subconscious. It's very important that we start to really take hold of this.
All right. For us, it comes down to power. Pure and simple. Folks, I certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much. We come back. Do you have a living will in place? Most black folks don't. Most Americans don't. But we'll help you get prepared to make such end-of-life decisions. Also, Emmy Award-winning journalist Mara Schiavocampo shares her weight loss journey in her new book, Thinspired. Next on News 1 Now on TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
A little news here. Police believe they have caught the arsonist responsible for the January 6th NAACP bombing office in Colorado. 44-year-old Thaddeus Murphy has been arrested on suspicion of arson and being a felon in possession of firearms. Murphy claims he was trying to bomb his old accountant, Steve DeHaven, when he mistakenly bombed the Colorado Springs NAACP office headquarters. Although there is a sign for a tax business outside of the building, the NAACP and a barbershop have been the only inhabitants in that building for the last 25 years. If convicted, Murphy faces about $500,000 in fines and 15 years in prison. All right, folks, while juggling marriage, a new baby, and an Emmy Award-winning journalism career, Mara Schiavocampo struggled with her weight, tipping the scales at 230 pounds. Y'all show in the book. Where's the photo of Mara at 230? Y'all show the photo? Then she accidentally stumbled on a, quote, magic formula that melted the pounds away. She chronicled her journey in her new book, Thinspired. Mara, what's happening?
Hey, Roland.
All right, so you had 230.
Yes, this is after I gave birth to my daughter.
Gotcha. All right, so what were you before you gave birth?
190. So I gained 40 pounds in pregnancy.
Gained 40 pounds. And so how long were you, after your daughter was born, Were you at 2:30 where you said, okay, I need to deal with this. What's going on?
I started the day I got back from the hospital because it was the heaviest I had ever been. Now, I had struggled with my weight for my entire life, but I kind of settled into a place where I was okay being a size 14. I felt good about myself.
Which, first of all, size 14 is the average size of a woman in America.
Absolutely. And I took a lot of pride being a woman at a size 14 on television because I wanted to reflect that segment of the population, which, frankly, we don't see a lot on television. So I did not feel bad about myself at that size. But when I gained 40 pounds in pregnancy, that was something I wasn't comfortable with. I wasn't comfortable in my skin. And so the day I got back from the hospital, having my daughter, I set out on this journey to lose the baby weight. And in that process, I learned so much about weight loss that I said to myself, well, why don't you see if you can lose 3 more pounds and 3 more mm-hmm. and 3 more all the way down to 90.
So you went to a 14 to a what?
Today I'm a size 6.
No. I'm talking about when you went to 230.
Oh, I don't know. It was maternity clothes.
No,
I mean, it was probably like a large, extra large in maternity, but that sizing is different from.
So was it for you? Oh, my goodness. Did it become a psychological thing for you? Did it become? What would people say about me at this size?
No, I was uncomfortable in that space, and I didn't want to go back to work in that space. So I really, when I left maternity leave, when I went back to work, wanted to be in my pre-baby clothes. So it was a very practical thing. Now, don't get me wrong. There have been so many times in my mm-hmm. life where I felt bad about myself, where there was a lot of self-loathing, you know, all those things that come with not being happy with your size. But at that point, that wasn't where I was. I was focused.
What was this magic formula? What is that?
So this is something that I came up with after the fact, after I lost the weight, because people kept asking me, what have you been doing? Mm-hmm. So I had to look back. And then in hindsight, I said, there really has been a very clear method to what I've been doing. So that's where the formula comes from. The formula is how I was directing my efforts. 70% of my efforts directed towards food. Food is the single biggest factor.
Right.
You will never lose or maintain weight loss without cleaning up your diet. 10% towards sleep, which is huge. When you're sleep deprived, you eat more.
Yep.
10% to planning, doing grocery shopping, doing the laundry, washing Tupperware, and 10% to exercise. That was the single biggest surprise for me, that exercise played a really small role in weight loss.
We've had nutritionists on the show, and they said really it's 80-20. It's 70-30, 80-20, but that is in terms of diet. So let's talk about food, because it's at 70%. What did you change? Was it a matter of foods that you were actually eating, or was it a matter of smaller portions? What did you change?
I'll tell you, there's only one thing that I did. I came to realize that there were certain foods that I could never eat in moderation. There were foods that I was abusing. And we all know we have those foods.
What were they for you?
For me, it was mainly baked goods. So flour products, you know, cupcakes, cookies, muffins. I'd have a blueberry muffin for breakfast every single day. So I had to eliminate the foods that I was abusing. I eliminated them completely. Mm-hmm. I know that I can't eat those things in moderation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that I did, because once I was only left with the foods that I don't abuse, I'm never going to eat broccoli till my stomach hurts. I'm never going to binge on salmon, right? Or raw almonds. So once I was dealing with the right kinds of food, I would just eat them in normal portions. That's the only change I made.
Well, you're right about that. I mean, I can tell you, for me, don't doubt bread and milk. I mean, I can sit here, and if I eat several of that in a week, I know 5 pounds will appear instantly.
Yes.
I mean, so it is understanding what it is about your body type, because some bodies are actually different than other bodies.
And it's about honesty. You know, don't tell yourself I can eat one cookie when you always eat the whole sleeve.
Yeah, you know you're lying.
So I know that I can eat one potato chip. Salt is not my thing. So that's me being honest with myself. So I can keep chips in the house. They're not a problem. You put some cookies in my house, I'm in big trouble. So you have to be really honest with yourself.
You talk about self-acceptance, and I think one of the things that is very interesting to me, and people kill me with the whole deal with skinny shaming, fat shaming, okay, whatever. But what gets me is when people don't understand self-esteem and self-acceptance, when they themselves would tear themselves down and degrade themselves because of how they look, as opposed to say, okay, even if I'm, to your point, if I'm a particular size, this is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I can be comfortable in that.
Right. I think, and I have found, that self-love and self-improvement go hand in hand. And too many people start the journey of self-improvement from a place of self-loathing. I know that because I've done that. And that's never going to be successful. The loving self says to you, when you fall, when you fail, when you do something that you didn't mean to do, the loving self says, what was going on? How can we make it better the next time? Not, you're stupid, you're fat, you're lazy, that will never get you to your goals. So taking care of the self and the spirit is so key to this process.
But it's also, I think, and last point here, that the reason you're doing it. And so, for instance, someone asked me, they said, like, I started this 20-day cleanse today. Because I did an interview with these folks in L.A., and we're going to run it later. I said, well, let's see how this thing works. So someone asked me, and they said, well, why do you want to lose weight? I said, my golf handicap. No, I was reading Golf Digest, right. And Butch Harmon said he dropped 35 or 40 pounds, and he added 15, 20 yards to his drive. I'm like, okay, I'm getting my handicap down from right. 8 to a 4. It doesn't matter what your motivation is.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be high-minded. Some people say, I want to be here for my children when they walk down the aisle and get married. Great. That's a really noble cause.
Right.
But I want to fit into a cute bathing suit in June. So that gets me there, too. So whatever gets you to your goal, whatever motivates you, whether it's your golf handicap, your kids, your heart health, it's all good.
No, you can keep the bathing suit. I'll go ahead and do the ball. That's what it is. Marsha, I appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Good to see you, Roland.
Folks, the book is Thinspired. So be sure to get it. Show it, please. Thank you very much. How I Lost 90 Pounds, My Plan for Lasting Weight Loss and Self-Acceptance. Mara, thanks a bunch. Coming up, I holler at my homeboy, Raheem Devon, about his new album. Yeah, pretty interesting. But coming up next, though, we'll deal with the issue of how do you make an end-of-life decision, something many of us, we have to face. 27 before top of the hour. News 1 Now on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
So how do you deal with death? How do you deal with a loved one who is sick, who has a terminal illness, and you have to prepare for the future? Well, the hit Fox television show Empire has brought this much-needed discussion to light by focusing on the character of Terrence Howard, who is suffering from ALS. And there are people out there who have Alzheimer's, who have other type of terminal illnesses, and they don't prepare themselves or their family for those difficult decisions. In fact, African Americans in particular are half as likely as whites to have a living will, life support, or senior care plans in place. Not having these plans can increase emotional turmoil, financial instability, and create lots of drama in a family. Joining me right now is Daniel Wilson, Program Director at Compassion and Choices, and also Thomas Bowen, Minister of Fellowship and Outreach at Shiloh Baptist Church. Gentlemen, glad you're on the show. I mean, this is something that we think that we have to deal with when it comes to elders, when it comes to our parents, when they get up in age. But we experience this with younger folks. We experience it with people in their teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s, all of a sudden they're in a hospital, they're incapacitated, they're in a coma, and all of a sudden people start going, well, what about, my goodness, their will, and what about this and that and the other, and don't realize all the inner workings on how that works when it comes to probate and out of court system and all the things along those lines.
Absolutely. You know, we believe that it's important for individuals to have the conversation early and often. You know, I often think about the times when I worked on the Hill. The number of the young staffers that we were all not from this area, our families were back home and weren't not necessarily aware of our daily abouts that we were doing. And if something were to happen, how will people know what it is that we want? And so that's why we at Compassion and Choices really believe that you have to have the conversation and you have to document it by doing an advanced healthcare directive, appointing a healthcare proxy, and again, having that conversation.
Well, let's just be honest. Who wants to talk about death? I mean, the thing is, I've met few people who actually want to have a conversation about, let's talk about if I die. And so that's part of the issue there. And so how do we get people to really begin that conversation? Is it a matter of starting with, hey, remember when so-and-so passed away, all the stuff that you had to deal with? How do we begin that discussion?
You're right, Roland. Sometimes in our community, we think to talk about death is to invite it. When it comes to a matter of
calling
our faith,
it forth.
Yes. And when it comes to our faith, we hold out for hope. But it's not a choice between faith and planning for our future. I believe that with that new popular religious show, Empire, and other things that happen in our society and culture, it opens up itself to opportunity to talk about these matters. You can even go back to Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun and how the failure to fully discuss the desires of the father played itself out throughout that play. So I think that now we ought to talk about it. And Christianity, in my belief, in my viewpoint, is a thinking person's religion. And we need to discuss these matters now. And as you stated, it impacts all of us, young and old.
Well, one of the things that also I think is critically important, even if we you look at the DNR, do not resuscitate. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who battle that. How do you also deal with, though, who's making what decisions? Because, you know, you might have a loved one, a son or a daughter, and the parents believe they're the ones who get to make the call. But what if that person is married? Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, that changes the equation as to who has the final authority to make end-of-life decisions.
That's why having that conversation is important, and you bring all of your family members to the table so that everyone is on board that what the decision will be made. They may not agree to it, they may not like it, but they know that it's a decision that you have made. You made it when you were mentally competent, because that's always can be a question, and that, you know, you're empowering the person to make the decision. You know, I always tell people, just because someone is your child who is legally your next of kin does not mean they're the person that you have to empower to make your healthcare decisions. Because let's just be honest, some family members are incapable of making those decisions. So using a healthcare proxy is that important tool to make that happen.
Beyond a DNR, beyond a living will, what are some of the other issues that come up as part of this end of life conversation?
Sure, you have advanced healthcare directives. People are questioning around, you know, do you want to be left on life support? What is it that you value at end of life? Do you want to be in a skilled nursing care facility? One of the big questions out there is, do you want a feeding tube? Where do you want to be when that end time is coming? Do you want to be at home? Do you want to be surrounded with your loved ones? Who can come visit you at the hospital? And so our organization, we have those resources available, which is called a Good to Go Guide. Mm-hmm. And it allows you to sort of highlight what your value system is at end of life.
Roland, our faith should give us the strength to handle these important questions. Someone once said, we can deal with death. It's living we have problems with, the day to day. In ministry, we often have premarital counseling. And when I offer it to couples, I talk about issues that may come up so they can begin to think about them. And I think the same can be applied when it comes to end-of-life decisions, that we ought to present people with things they ought to consider, particularly when we have situations playing themselves out in front of our eyes, so that those of us who have not made our preparation and plans can do so.
Tomorrow here in D.C., there's going to be this discussion, a one-day conversation. I'll pull the graphic up, please, called The Journey Home, an African-American Conversation, taking place from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Washington SunTrust Bank headquarters. It is a free event, but you have to RSVP. Is this event going to be live-streamed?
It will not be, unfortunately.
Okay.
But we will make sure that.
So my suggestion would be, are you guys recording this event?
Yes.
My suggestion is you record the event. And then make it available on the website, so, and then let us know, so people who obviously can't attend other parts of the country can actually go back and actually watch it and listen to the whole dialogue to learn more about it. So I certainly appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Folks, coming up, Raheem Devon talks about his new single, Queen, and his new album, Love, Sex, Passion. Also, TLC, they're planning one last studio album, and they need your help in raising money via crowdsourcing. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at News1 or at Roland S. Martin, or go to our News 1 Facebook page. 16 before the top of the hour at News 1 Now on TV1.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks, Raheem Devon is a fantastic singer. Many folks know him as a love doctor. That is his Twitter handle as well. He is a phenomenal guy. He has a new album out. It's called Love, Sex, and Passion. And I recently sat down with DC's finest to talk about the album. Check it out. I'm always interested in how we folks come up with album titles.
You know, I always wanted to have an album that was kind of like reminiscent of a slow jam tape, mm-hmm. you know, or my version of Prince, Purple Rain, or Marvin Gaye, I Want You, R. Kelly, 12 Play. So this is that for me, this project, this moment, you know?
Now, so it's Love, Sex, Passion. That's three distinct things.
Yeah, definitely.
So what does love mean?
I think for me, I mean, you know, all the topics, I think I broke them down extensively on this album. You know, love is you know, emotions and caring for yourself, mm-hmm. first and foremost. You know, it can be a roller coaster ride, you know, which I touch on that on the cut called When You Love Somebody on the album. You know, I talk about the good and the bad of it, you know, scratching up your Mercedes. You know,
that ain't love, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy, huh?
That's crazy.
You know, so I just really went on a roller coaster ride of all of that, man, and just try to make the album as poetic as possible. You know, when you talk about sex and intimacy, you know, I like to think that I'm one of the brothers that does that tastefully and not so raunchy, you know.
And then there's passion.
You know, I think that's where you bring in the mental connection. You know, that's where the pheromones kick in. That's where the dialogue kicks in. You know, and once again, you know, the Love, Sex, and Passion album is like, you know, it's the bed music, per se, to, you know, to create that dialogue, you know, whatever it is, whatever your vice is, cracking a bottle of wine, playing spades, you know, with your lady on a couple night, whatever that is, you know, or just someone that you just engaging with, I think, you know, for the first time, plutonically or whatever, you know, like, it really just creates a soundtrack to that.
Obviously, the music game has changed in that you don't have the diversity of radio station formats that will allow for a new song to take hold. You, like so many others, are extremely active in the social media space because it then becomes a word of mouth thing. It then becomes, I saw him live, and all of a sudden. So it's different in terms of how you have to get your songs out.
To market and promote, it's almost like, you know, television, and with the exception of the Roland Martin show.
I gotta do the same thing.
You know, television and radio, man, it becomes secondary almost to social networking and to word of mouth. And I think that's the grassroots side of it. That's the old school side of it, the part that I love. You know, I think that's, you know, reminiscent of the 60s, 70s, you know, in particular. You know, we didn't have all those, you know, vices to be able to, you know, communicate, so people would just spread the word about great music. And, you know, my project is a testament to that, you know, having the number one, you know, R&B album, soul album, you know, this week on the charts, like, that's big.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the live performance part, because that really does change it, if you will. And so how's it for you, though, when folks react to your music differently when it's live, but the studio sound also is a lot different because it doesn't have the same energy, if you will, that a live performance does.
It's, you know, the studio, the purpose of the studio for me, you know, you try to come up with the best material possible, the quote unquote, the hit, you know, the timeless record, you know, there's one record on this album in particular that I feel like it's one of those records I step outside of myself, and every time I hear the record, I'm like, wow, that's me. Like, where did that come from? You know, I'm thankful for that place that came from. You know, the live performance aspect, it's a whole nother exchange of energy. It's a whole nother high. You know, engaging to have fans, you know, all around the world knowing your music, knowing your material. You take countries like Japan, for example, where, you know, the English language dialect is secondary, but they know every word. You know, so it definitely one of the most humbling things I ever experienced in my life, you know, and I thoroughly enjoy performing, you know, every chance that I get. I hope that people see that, you know, and when we connect, you know, it can definitely help sales as well, you know.
What female singer you would love to do something with?
Man, one female singer. Right about now, you know, I probably would go with Sade.
Really?
Yeah, I would go with Sade.
Now that's a hard one there.
Yeah, I would go with Sade.
She does whatever she wants to do.
Yeah.
All right, I ain't gonna sing for 10 years.
Yeah, I'll
come back, drop one, then disappear.
It's a mystique about it, and you know, it's a vibe about her and the mystique that I think the artistry and, you know, definitely the penmanship as far as wanting to write and you know, even in collaboration, I just think that would be a dope marriage in the studio.
Is there a brother you would want to hook up with in the studio?
That's a tough one, but I probably would have to go with Prince.
Also, a tough one. Yeah, you're right.
I would have to go with Prince, you know, and that's whether he writes the song or we co-write it or he produces it or just the experience of the creative process. Just always been curious about just seeing that, you know, just being a fly on the wall. Like that's an OG. You got to pay homage. Even lost a Grammy to him one year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, definitely.
You're like, okay, I lose the Prince.
Yeah, you know
Prince.
What? It's like, yo, if I'm losing the Prince, hey, salute.
All right, Love, Sex, Passion, folks. Raheem Devon, it is in stores now. You can also download it. Amazon, iTunes, however you download it. Man, so appreciate it. Keep handling your business.
Oh, thank you so much, Roland.
All right, thanks a bunch, folks. Raheem Devon right here on News 1 Now. TV.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Forget record labels. Just go right to the people. That's what TLC did, raising money to bring you one last studio album. Hip Hollywood reporter Ashley Williams caught up with the sexy Chili to talk about the group's latest project.
TLC has a huge year ahead of them. A tour with New Kids on the Block and Nelly.
I love performing. I just do.
And a new album. Chili and T-Boz are raising money via Kickstarter to bring fans one last and final project.
It's right up TLC's alley as far as doing things outside the box. It's what we've always been about. This was a great platform for us to do this new album and do it with our fans without any, you know, extra voices and stuff like that. It's about the connection with our fans because they're the ones who want this album. I mean, not to say that we don't want to record new music, but they are definitely the motivation behind all of this for us.
With this new project, the group will be reintroducing themselves to a new, younger generation, which Chili says VH1's biopic also helped do.
TLC was definitely back on the radar for many people, especially here in the States. We got a whole new generation of fans, you know, like little kids, you know, like five-year-olds, seriously.
Among some of the thousands of fans fronting money for what will be the first studio album by just T-Boz and Chili, Grammy Award-nominated singer Katy Perry, who donated a whopping $5,000.
It meant a lot that she did that. We didn't know that she was a fan. You know, we're definitely fans of hers, but it was a shocker. We were like, is that the real Katy Perry?
And for some incentive, TLC promised a sleepover for fans who donated $5,000. So what would that night look like with Perry?
We're big kids, and Katy Perry seems to be the same way. And so I just think that it would just, who knows what would happen. We may go and start pranking and knocking on people's doors and running and whatnot. So, you know, anything could happen at a TLC sleepover. Hey guys, I just want to say thank you so much for all your pledges with Kickstarter, but we still have to get to 10,000 pledges. So go to kickstarter.com, search TLC, and make your pledge. I promise you the rewards are everything. Everything.
For HipHollywood.com, I'm Ashley Williams.
And since Ashley did this, they actually have raised their money for the project. So congratulations to Chili as well as T-Boz. All right, folks. Hey, I just got a tweet from Ron Brownstein saying News 1 Now is being shown on the big screen at LAX Airport. What up, L.A.? All right, just giving y'all a shout-out. All right, birthday shout-out time. Yesterday, NBA Hall of Famer Julius Dr. J. Irving turned 65. Today, actress Niecy Nash turns 45. And entrepreneur Damon John, owner of FUBU, you also see him on Shark Tank. He turns 46 years old. On this day in history, in 1979, Frank Peterson Jr. becomes the first black brigadier general in the U.S. Marine Corps. In 1965, Constance Baker Motley becomes the highest elected African-American woman. She also later becomes a federal judge. She was one of the lawyers involved in the civil rights movement. Tomorrow, folks, on News 1 Now, Congressman Shaka Fatah and Congressman John Conyers talk about the 6th annual Heritage Voice Awards, and we'll take a look at the documentary Little Ballers about urban youth sports. Yours truly was in that. It was done by Adrian Lopez as well as Crystal McCrary. So we'll look forward to that. Folks, go to news1.com for more stories and updates. You can also follow me on Twitter at Roland S. Martin, and be sure to friend the show page, the News 1 Now page on Facebook as well. It has been fabulous being with you. Again, congratulations to my homeboys, Common and John Legend, on their Oscar, also their Image Award, and their Golden Globe. They're cleaning up when it comes to glory. I expect them to win a Grammy next year. You have a great day. See you tomorrow. Holla!
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.